Narnia and the Watchful Dragons by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract, a sketch of the seven Narnia Chronicles and C.S. Lewis's purposes in writing them. How Lewis uses Morifalk to help us see anew the power of the biblical salvation story. Some lessons we can learn from the series. Ever since the Narnia Chronicles first appeared over 50 years ago, the Narnia books by C.S. Lewis have been enormously popular. They're written for kids, millions of adults have read them, and not just aloud to their children. Obviously, these books have struck a chord with young and old alike. There have been various productions of the Narnia series. Who knows how many dramas. The Narnia series has been made into audios, both narrated and dramatized. The stories have also been produced for video, both in live and cartoon formats. Now, Walt Disney Pictures and Walden Media are in the midst of producing an elaborate and expensive film series. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe has been out now for a couple of years. The Prince Caspian is scheduled for distribution this May, and presumably, if that goes well, there will be others to follow them. We're going to give here first a sketch of the books. The first in the Narnia series, as it was originally published, is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Here are four children, Pevensey family, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy, come to live in the rural mansion of an elderly professor to escape the London air raids during World War II. They're accidentally transported to a parallel world, Narnia, by entering an old wardrobe. This Narnia is inhabited by talking animals and various other magical creatures. It has been enchanted by the wicked witch Jadis, so it is always winter, but never Christmas, and this has been going on for nearly a century at this point. The Pevensey kids, in the course of this story, help the lion Aslan rescue Narnia from the witch's power. The second book is Prince Caspian. After about a year of Earth time, the Pevenseys return to Narnia, but find that 1,000 years have passed in Narnia. Narnia is at this point being oppressed by wicked King Miraz, who is opposed by his nephew Caspian and the talking animals. When all seems lost, Aslan, Caspian, and the Pevenseys defeat Miraz's forces and free the good Narnian creatures. Book 3. Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Edmund and Lucy, the two youngest of the Pevenseys, and their cousin Eustace are magically transported to Narnia to join Caspian's exploration in the Eastern Sea. Caspian, who has now been king for a couple of years, is seeking seven of his father's noblemen who left when Miraz was king. In the course of the book, after many exciting adventures, they reach the uttermost east of the Narnian world, where Reepicheep the Mouse finds his heart's desire, and the children meet Aslan. Book 4, The Horse and His Boy. This book is set during the latter part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Pevenseys spend many years in Narnia on their first full visit, and grow up, and then revert to children as they come back to our world. So this is set during the latter part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And this story follows the adventures of poor boy Shasta, who runs away from home in Kalorman, the Urbic world to the south of Narnia, when he realizes that he is about to be sold into slavery. He is accompanied by a warhorse named Bree, a talking animal who had been owned by the guy who was about to buy him. And later they meet the upper-class girl Erebus, from the Kalorman nobility, and her mare Huynh, also escaping to the north. They eventually do escape to the north and save a kingdom in the process, Arkenland. Book 5, The Silver Chair. Eustace, the character who first shows up in number 3, The Dawn Treader, and Jill are called into Narnia by Aslan to find and rescue Prince Rillian from a wicked witch, the Queen of Underland. accompanied by a marsh wiggle named Puddleglum, and guided by four clues that Aslan has given them, the two travel into the wild north in winter. In spite of botching nearly all the clues, they do succeed, and the story ends more or less happily. Sixth book of the Narnia series is The Magician's Nephew. This story is set many years before the others, and involves the boy Diggory, who is the old professor in the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, and his neighbor, Polly, Diggory's sick mother, and Diggory's magic-dabbling Uncle Andrew. Tricked into using Andrew's magic rings, Diggory and Polly travel to other worlds. They see the creation of Narnia, and inadvertently bring the wicked witch Jadis into Narnia. Book 7, The Last Battle. The main characters here are again Eustace and Jill from number 5, The Silver Chair. This is the time now in Narnia, centuries later than their previous visit, and the last king of Narnia, Tyrion, is ruling, and in the story he is captured and overthrown by a plot involving a clever ape who fashions a fake Aslan and works in alliance with the soldiers of Cul Orman. The real Aslan intervenes, brings an end to Narnia, and ushers in a new Narnia further up and further in. In recent years, the Narnia books have been issued in a new order that is chronological, so it starts with The Magician's Nephew, and then moves on to The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, then followed by The Horse and His Boy, then by Prince Caspian, then The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, then The Silver Chair, and finally The Last Battle. So The Magician's Nephew starts at the beginning of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, Wardrobe perhaps several thousand years later, The Horse and His Boy a few years after that one begins and before it ends, Prince Caspian, again, about 1,000 years later, the Dawn Treader just a few years after that, and the Silver Chair then many hundreds of years, a generation after the Dawn Treader, and then the Last Battle, many hundreds or perhaps even some thousands of years after the Silver Chair. In this talk, we want to consider several different topics, and just briefly of each. What is C.S. Lewis trying to do in the Narnia series? And our simple answer will be, he's trying to slip past the watchful dragons, the reason for our title of this PowerPoint talk. What is Lewis teaching in the Narnia series? Well, basically, biblical Christianity. How is he going about this? Well, he is using a technique which is called by some Morifock. So that's what we want to look at here. Let's have a look. What is Lewis doing? Well, Lewis tells us, in an essay he wrote, which is now available in a collection of his essays entitled Of Other Worlds. This is found in page 37 of my edition. Lewis says, I thought I saw how stories of this kind, fairy stories, could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to, and reverence itself did harm. But supposing by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency, could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? Well, that's what Lewis is doing. He's casting the truths of Christianity into an imaginary world in such a way that a person is gripped by the stories themselves, is gripped by the content of salvation history without being put off by the fact that you're being taught some religion or something of that sort, or told that you need to be reverent, or you need to react to this in a certain way. What are these things that Lewis is teaching in Narnia? Well, there are a lot of them. I'm going to sketch a few of them for us here. We find, of course, a sketch of creation in The Magician's Nephew. And in that same book, we find a picture of sin entering the world with Jadis coming to Narnia. The central event, in some sense, of Christianity, Jesus dying for sin and rising again, is pictured in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in which Aslan dies for Edmund, and then comes to life again. Themes in Prince Caspian are not perhaps so obviously biblical as those in The Magician's Nephew and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but we certainly have the theme of freedom and tyranny and that sort of thing pictured there in the struggle between Prince Caspian's uncle, Miraz, and his attempt to put down and destroy the talking beasts and even oppress his own people. And I think we get a very strong picture of supernatural aid in Prince Caspian as well. I'll come back to that when I discuss more. In each of these stories, you would find it a worthwhile endeavor, I think, to try and walk through them and see what biblical principles are being taught in these particular stories. You'll find quite a few of them. The Voice of the Dawn Treader has a number of things. It's got the redemption of Edmund of Eustace in it, turning his life around, if you like, from a arrogant, annoying brat, if you like, to someone who is much more humble and helpful. But one of the main themes, I think, is that of the mouse Reepicheep seeking life's meaning and seeking God, really, is what it amounts to, I think. In The Horse and His Boy, we could find, I think, a number of things, but perhaps the one of the biggest themes is what we might call the last shall be first. The boy is a slave. He's looked down upon by his talking horse, and then when they meet up with Erebus and Gwyn, Erebus, upper class, Caloriman, princess, if you like, almost, looks down on him as well, and such, but he really turns out to be the hero in the end, and turns out also to be the lost son of the king of Arkenland, and so it's this idea of finding one's true identity, perhaps, or a lost identity or something of that sort, as well as this theme, the last shall be first. In The Silver Chair, one of the big themes that runs through the whole story, of course, is that Aslan has given the kids guidance in the form of these four clues, these four signs that they're to memorize and to be on the lookout for. And they kind of blunder through it, but except for the last sign, they basically botch them up. And it reminds us, in some sense, of the fact that God has given us guidance in His Word, and yet we very frequently botch things up by not understanding what it's about or paying attention or that sort of thing. The incident, particularly in connection with the escape of Rillian from the Silver Chair and the attempt of the Queen of Underland to enchant him and his rescuers, raises the whole question of what is real and how do we know? What is real versus what is fake? How do we know? The last of the seven notebooks, The Last Battle, again picks up things that are quite obviously specific events in biblical salvation history. The Antichrist theme and the whole idea of the monkey trying to make a fake Aslan. The end of the world, the last judgment, if you like, and heaven are big themes as well in Narnia at that point. So we can see that the books, particularly as reordered in the newer form that starts with The Magician's Nephew and ends with The Last Battle, gives us kind of a movement through salvation history. We're looking at the salvation history of Narnia, but it parallels that of our world as well. One way in which Lewis helps us to see these important truths is by using a technique that some people call Morifock. Strange name, huh? Morifock is a literary device by which the author sets up a situation so that the reader will experience a truth from an unusual angle, perhaps coming to see the power of this truth for the first time. What is Maury Falk? Well, the picture on the right-hand side gives you a little idea. This is what J.R.R. Tolkien has to say about it in the Tolkien Reader, page 58. And there is, he says, especially for the humble, Maury Falk, or Chestertonian fantasies. That's another term that could be used for it. Maury Falk is a fantastic word, which could be seen written up in every town in this land. He's writing from England. It is coffee room, viewed from the inside through a glass door. So viewed backwards, if you like, it's written to be read from out on the street, and you're inside the coffee room looking out at it. As it was seen by Charles Dickens on a dark London day. And it was used by Chesterton to denote the queerness of things that have become trite when they're suddenly seen from a new angle. Well, what kind of Maury Falk do we see in Narnia? Well, of course, the whole series. The basic truths of Christianity are transposed to a fairy tale world. So things that might seem to kids as off-putting or something, or trite, if you like, and particularly might seem to some adults who have perhaps been turned off and walked away from Christianity as trite, are seen from a new angle that allows them to see the power of the Christian story. The basic truths of Christianity transposed to a fairy tale world. There are a number of brief touches of Maury Falk in Narnia. We're going to just look at one of them as Lucy in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe reads the titles of books in the Fawn Tumnus's library. Then we're going to look at a more extended Maury Falk that occurs in The Silver Chair as Puddleglum responds to the Queen of Underland. And finally, we're going to think a little bit about Maury Falk and angels, which turns out to be kind of a surprise in this whole story. Well, let's look at, first of all, at Tumnus's library, as Lucy has accompanied Tumnus to his cave to have tea, and as she's waiting while he's fixing the tea, she sees the title of a book on a shelf, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend, or Is Man a Myth? Chapter 2 of The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. Well, this should cause the readers to see something from a new angle. If man, whom we know exists, is considered mythological by some fauns, meaning that some of the beings we consider mythological also exist. Well, you might or might not think of that, but there it is. The author has said it before you as something to think about and a little humor, if you like. And yet, in a sense, this little Maury Falk in the description of Tumnus's library provides a good preparation for kids who are probably going to be trained in modern secularism if they go to public schools, and for those who have already grown up and have been trained in modern secularism, for more sympathetic reading of biblical narratives, which include angels and demons, whom many people consider mythological also. Man, whom we know exists, is considered mythological by some fauns, meaning that some of the beings we consider mythological also exist. So maybe you ought to read the Bible accounts with a little more open mind. The Queen's Enchantment, the Queen of Underland, Emerald Witch, if you like, attempts to enchant Eustace, Jill, Puddleglum, and Rillian when she returns to find out that they have delivered Rillian from his enchantment and destroyed the Silver Chair. And so she attempts to enchant them to believe that there is no other world than his. We see this in The Silver Chair, Chapter 12. Basically, the Queen argues that the belief of Eustace, Jill, Puddleglum, and Rillian in the sun is just an extrapolation, an imagination, an expanded version of the lamp in the ceiling. And there isn't any sun, there's just this lamp, and they've sort of, in their fantasy, have imagined a sun. And that their belief in Aslan, who is the Christ figure of the whole Narnia series, is merely an expanded version of a house cat. Notice how these arguments mimic the atheist argument that God is just an expanded version of a human. There's no God, they say, but you have just taken the idea of a human and you try to pick, you know, imagine the best human you can and the most powerful human, etc., and expanded that beyond what any human is capable of, and that's how you've got the idea of God. That's where the idea of God came from. One of them has a good answer, and we just extract here a paragraph or so of it. Puddleglum, having stepped in the fire to produce pain in himself to clear his mind and to make a terrible stink of the fire which had been had some incense thrown in it to aid the enchantment, says to the witch, "Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all these things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which flits your real world hollow." That provides, for the reader, a response to the atheist version that there's no God. Well, your world with no God is a pretty crummy world, after all. And you think we're the ignorant ones. And yet this world that we see in the light of what the Bible teaches is a far better world than the one you are imagining. And the suggestion is it's because our world is the real one, and it wasn't designed by us, merely ignorant humans. It was designed by the God who actually exists. Lastly, we look at an example of Morifok and angels. This is another example, about as extensive as the whole Narnia series, is the way Lewis gives us a backdoor approach to angels. As we read the stories, we're inclined to identify with the children who travel back and forth from our world to Narnia. But if we look at it from the perspective of Narnia, we are beginning to function as angels in Narnian salvation history. Angels in our world come from who knows where, show up, intervene, do some things, deliver some messages, help out in some way, and then disappear. The children show up in Narnia, do some things, occasionally deliver messages, and then disappear from Narnian salvation history. If this isn't an example of stealing past the watchful dragons, I don't know what is. How many stories have you ever read in which you, by identifying with the characters, function as angels? Well, that's the end of our discussion here at the Chronicles of Narnia. Not intended to be anything complete or anything of that sort, but something to whet your appetite for you to look around in the Chronicles of Narnia and to see some other Morifoks that you may not have noticed that we haven't talked about here, to think through how the history of Narnia parallels in many ways the salvation history of our planet Earth, and the kind of lessons you can learn about good and evil, about how we should behave, about how important it is to make right decisions and to be unselfish, by seeing how it affected the characters in Narnia, and then to determine that we will try to live our lives here and now in this world in a way that will cause us to be, what shall we say, the heroes of the story that we are living in, and not the bad guys. The Chronicles of Narnia are a way to visualize, appreciate, and feel biblical truths.